The Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, Washington, D.C.'s neglected Anacostia River struggles to renew its health with help from the folks who live in its banks. Polluted and abandoned industrial sites or brownfields in cities and towns can be redeveloped, saving greenfields out in the countryside. We talk green about how it can be done. And in the Earth calendar, swifts swirl down a chimney in Oregon. Does the chimney sweep become a gourmet chef specializing in bird's nest soup? These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. Two rivers flow through our nation's capital. The more famous one is the Potomac River, with well-known monuments along its banks. The city's other river is the Anacostia. Few tourists visit the area, which runs through the eastern half of the city. It's the other side of Washington, D.C., poor, minority, and often neglected. The fight for the Anacostia's survival may signal hope for communities across the country. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally brings us this report from Washington.
The tide slowly creeps up the muddy shore of the Anacostia River, while a turtle suns itself on a log about 50 feet off. Undeveloped green space like this area covers much of the shore, all the way up to the Anacostia's mouth. So in some ways, it's hard to believe you're in a city. But the garbage floating on the water, strewn in the tree branches, and littering the grass brings you back to reality.
You can look around and you can see the debris all over the place. The debris may appear cosmetic, but it's a symptom of not caring. It's a symptom of neglect and marginalizing the very thing that sustains us as our natural world.
Robert Boone is with the Anacostia Watershed Society. He says the river has a long history of human interaction, first with Native Americans and then with European settlers. During colonial times, Bladensburg, Maryland, on the Anacostia and just north of Washington, was the most active port around. It linked the area's tobacco fields with the Chesapeake Bay and out to the ocean. But by the mid-1800s, agricultural runoff filled the Anacostia and it became unnavigable. Its banks became home to many freed slaves, and Washington became a highly segregated city, which it remains today. Through this time, the Anacostia, like rivers elsewhere, was used as the city's source for drinking water and, at the same time, its primary sewage dump. Jim Connolly is the executive director of the Anacostia Watershed Society. He says times haven't changed much.
It's probably the single biggest problem affecting the D.C.'s rivers, particularly the Anacostia, is combined sewer overflows, where you have, during a rainstorm, raw sewage gets diverted into the river before it gets to the treatment plant. And that causes, that's 1.2 billion gallons a year in D.C.'s water. So that's quite a big slug of pollution that's affecting the health of the river.
But Robert Boone says, looking at it from a broader perspective, the problem facing the Anacostia is the same facing other rivers around the world.
Human habitation is basically the biggest problem. The Potomac watershed is huge compared to the Anacostia, but four-fifths of all the people that live in the Potomac watershed live in Washington. And it's where we are, it's where the problem is. And it's just our lifestyle, our impervious surfaces, and our refusal to get out of the car, to stop driving.
While people are the source of the river's problem, some people are hoping to be the solution. All around the Anacostia, its neighbors are rediscovering the river and beginning to fight for its renewal. Fraser Walton is the president of the Kingman Park Neighborhood Association. At a recent community cleanup, Walton joined a group of his neighbors with rakes and brooms to pick up trash and stencil "Don't Dump Anacostia River Drainage" on the sewers.
The Anacostia has been neglected for the last 30, 40 years. And just recently has the Anacostia, have we begun to get some attention. We have a slogan that says the river swimmable and fishable by 2000. And that's our goal, is to make this river a fishable, swimmable river. It runs along a national park system, and it's everybody's river. And we're hoping that everybody will have the use of the river. And of course, not to speak of the drinking water aspect. We're trying to overemphasize, like today with the stenciling project, that this water is the very water that goes to the treatment plant in southwest on the Potomac and used for our drinking water.
One of the key strategies to garner support for the Anacostia is to get people to use the river. Today, some area kids are on Anacostia rowing teams, and groups like the Anacostia Watershed Society lead canoe trips down the river. But many here feel all these efforts may be in vain if a new development goes through. Last year, Congress passed a bill, later signed by President Clinton, which transferred from the Park Service two now undeveloped islands in the middle of the Anacostia to the Washington City government for the sole purpose of leasing it out for a theme park. The move infuriated environmentalists who said it sets a dangerous precedent. But the city hopes the 6,000 visitors expected each day will bring in badly needed cash. Fraser Walton says it's a lousy idea.
We don't believe that the city and our elected officials should be involved in profit-making ventures for private corporations. This should be a function of the private sector, not of the government. The government's function is to keep the health, safety, and the welfare of the community going, i.e. keeping the river clean. And that's not their priority as we see it. And we're saying that that goes right to the heart of environmental justice. And so we will fight the local government on that issue as well.
While some of Walton's neighbors picked up trash, others handed out signs saying no theme park on the Anacostia River. Most people gladly mounted them in their front yards. This neighborhood and others along the Anacostia are a long way from the flashy images of Washington's lawmakers, celebrity journalists, and stately buildings. But through them flows a river, which many see as a symbol of hope and renewal for an area long neglected. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We're talking green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about brownfields. These are properties that have been contaminated with chemical pollution. In many cases, they're the guts of cities and towns where factories once stood. If they can be developed, greenfields or open space outside of town might be saved, but first they have to be cleaned up. Developers are wary of liability, and community leaders want to make sure the environment is safe. Are there old industrial sites in your town that could be developed? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And my guests today are two experts. Charlie Bartsch, Senior Policy Analyst specializing in economic development issues at the Northeast Midwest Institute in Washington, D.C., and Juanita Joyner. She's at ILES. It's a nonprofit community development corporation based in Trenton, New Jersey, and she's Director of Community Development and Site Remediation. Charlie Bartsch, let's start with you. Are there a lot of brownfields around the country, and why are they getting so much attention?
Well, there are a lot around the country, and there's been different studies done. I mean, it's kind of a hard number to get a real fix on, but there's a number of estimates, you know, in the 500,000 range. So clearly there's a lot of sites, and they really are everywhere.
Now, when you say 500,000 brownfields, what is a brownfield as far as you see it? What would fall into that category?
Well, I think EPA has put together a very good definition, which is certainly one that I kind of go by. And a brownfield is a site or a facility where the contamination, and then here's the second part is an important part, or the perceived threat of contamination really affects the ability to reuse the site for the reasons you just laid out, you know, liability and so forth.
For people who haven't thought about it, we're talking about a place that has got either so much contamination or people think it's so bad, they don't want to be there.
Right. And it may not have to be so bad. I mean, a lot of probably many thousands of sites that fall into that number may be just closed gas stations where it's just an old tank in the ground. And a lot of the sites are very small. they really, really do run the range. I mean, they're not, it's not just the abandoned huge steel site. It's the sites that are really
so
in pretty much every community.
All over. So, Juanita Joyner, you're with a nonprofit organization that's involved mm-hmm. in community development.
Yes.
What are the special problems from a community perspective that are presented when a brownfield site is to be developed?
Well, there's several, really. One of the problems that we've incurred when we first go into a community, we have found that communities have gotten to the point where they really have accepted the brownfield. And I mean that in the sense that since it's been sitting there for so long, they have basically internalized and said, well, I guess this is just part of our community. When we have gone in to say to them, well, look, there's a possibility that this may be redeveloped, the very first challenge that we come up against is one of trust, that element of trust. Traditionally, brownfield redevelopment has really been put to the side only for developers and municipal governments.
So that means that if there's a site in the middle of, and I'm thinking of a small town now where they had a little factory that made log homes and they put preservative all over the ground and it's now contaminated mm-hmm. with dioxin, if the community wanted to develop that into a playground, for example,
it becomes really difficult.
They can't do it because of the dioxin.
Well, it becomes very difficult. I won't say they can't do it, but let me use a site that we have right here in the city of Trenton. It's the Magic Marker site, and it's called that only because Magic Marker was the last tenant. This particular site was used for about 30 or 40 years for the manufacture of batteries. Very high levels of lead, ranging from 400 to 49,000 parts per million.
Pretty scary stuff.
Very, very scary, because anything over 400 parts per million, you don't want folks around. Because the levels are so high, it actually has been deemed an environmental site on contact, so there's a fence around it. When you ask what does it mean to a community when they have these kind of sites, let me give you another example using the same site. Directly across the street, diagonally, is a public school. Elementary school. There's no green space. So what do children do? Of course, children are children. They look at that as an urban Disneyland, a place to play, to run across, to have adventures. Less than 100 feet on the north side of the building is a residential street where people have experienced residue of ash and things of that sort falling off the roof of the building. So when they go in to redevelop, one of the first things the community says is, can we be involved? Can we be involved in that decision-making piece?
Now, Charlie, I know that one of the things that you hear a lot about is developers saying, we'll develop, but we don't want to clean it up
right.
to the same standards that EPA would otherwise require because it's too expensive or what have you. How is that situation normally dealt with in these redevelopment projects?
Well, actually, just a tiny clarification. I mean, EPA, federal EPA, is getting, I think very much more, realistic and open-minded in how they as to how they look at cleanup standards, and they are very willing to work with states to define alternatives for sites that may not be used for things like playgrounds or you know, for homes where, you know, families with children are going to be. And I think really what is really starting to happen, and again, we the Institute have looked at about 30 successful reuse situations, you know, projects where they've really overcome all these barriers and had real success stories. And in virtually every case, responsible, active community involvement played a very important role in helping to determine what would be used at those sites. And then once those decisions are made, that really does help you, you know, as Juanita was suggesting, just determine really the type and the nature of the cleanup that you have to do. And it's because we are now getting to the point where we recognize that variables can be accepted and they can work and they can be protective of the environment, the environment and the people who are going to have contact with those sites. I think sort of flexibility is really generating a lot of opportunities.
Let's look at that within the context of an email question we had. And the question was, I live in St. Louis, and there are sites which I'm told have not been developed because developers are afraid of liability.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that question? What is being done so that a developer might come into a site that they would not otherwise because they're afraid they may get sued.
Well, there's probably a lot of factors at play at that site, and I think what we're finding with a lot of our examples, if the economics can work, if the numbers can work, there's not the liability issues can be overcome.
And so what have you learned about how the community ought to get involved when people start talking about developing a site that might be right in the middle of where they live?
Absolutely. Well, number one, we advocate that the community should be involved from the very beginning because we realize that redevelopment is a long-term process. It acts as a wonderful catalyst for going into a community and beginning to build capacity and relationships with community folks. And also, it offers us an opportunity to begin educating people about environmental issues, about why it's important to protect the environment, about questions that they need to ask the city and developers. It also gets them prepared so that by the time a decision is really ready to be made, which is usually about 2 or 3 years out, you've got a community who is now well-versed. They understand the process. They understand information.
Okay, well, let's go to the call. Let's go to the phones, and I see that we have a call from Mary in Chicago. Mary, you're talking Green on the Environment Show.
Thank you. I'm Mary Nelson from Bethel New Life, which is a church-based community development corporation, very much involved in turning our environmental problems into possibilities for community economic development.
How's it coming?
Well, exciting stuff happening. We turned the fact that we were next to an incinerator into an opportunity to develop some recycling businesses, a material processing plant, a cash buyback center.
So you're the kind of community leader that Juanita was talking about, that the community has to get involved. How does a community get one of these dead, poison sites doing something productive for the folk that live around it? What did you folks do?
Well, we are fortunate in having a partnership with the Argonne National Laboratory, a National Department of Energy lab, and who have helped us learn the skills, and we've passed on to others. We call it environmental triage, industrial triage, looking at the old industrial buildings in our area to identify which ones are redeemable, not just from an environmental point of view, but also for a good business site.
And how did you deal with the issue of how much contamination is acceptable?
Well, we're participants in Illinois on a whole initiative trying to sort out can you have different gradations of acceptable things for industrial reuse sites that might be a little different from acceptable conditions for land for a daycare center.
Exactly.
Shirley Bartsch, let me ask you about that. The idea, as I take it, that's catching on is that instead of having a standard level of cleanup, you clean up to the degree necessary depending on what's going to be used there.
Exactly.
Is that good public policy? What about
I think it's realistic public policy because one of the reasons that really spearheaded the growth of the brownfields issue is the fact that there's so many sites where nothing is being done, and then conversely we're losing so much, farmland and exurban area. And so there's just a real reason to have to deal with this. And I think that one of the things that's happening is I think there's being a very interesting marriage of I think science and the needs of people. I mean, we're much better now than we were even a couple of years ago, at using technology to identify contamination, to determine, how clean needs to be clean for any given site. And with, I think, strong community involvement, you can start making some of the land use decisions that make sense for an area that can bring some development back and also provide for really a safe environment for people to live. And one other quick point, too, if you can identify in a site in a community and everyone can agree that it need only be cleaned to an industrial use for a new industrial purpose, what that translates to in dollar terms for a prospective developer, it can be hundreds of thousands of dollars of savings.
Mary, thanks for your call. The thing that I think that is so interesting about this issue is that ours is a country that's always looked at land as something you could use up and move west.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've hit the ocean, the core of our cities is rotting, and we're building shopping malls and so on around the outside. Presumably a good Brownfields program could be the key to revitalization of urban areas, couldn't it?
There's no question.
Absolutely. If I could, I wanted to just touch on something that Mary said, which I think is critical to the success of this, especially if you want to talk about long-term successful sustainability in communities with brownfield development. And she mentioned the word partnerships. And I think that's absolutely critical, and we want to make sure we don't lose sight of the importance of partnerships and of building linkages with the community, with the Department of Environmental Protection, with government, with educational institutions, and the list goes on and on. I think that once we've been able to solidify these partnerships, it forms a wonderful foundation for building.
Well, let me ask you something that seems to be going on out there. I saw a circular recently from an insurance company that was putting together a pot of something like several hundred millions of dollars and literally dozens and dozens of sites, and they were going to go into the business with partners of a massive redevelopment scheme in which these sites were being treated almost like bananas. They were getting them in bunches. Is this, Charlie, where the brownfields movement is taking us as relates to development around the country?
Well, there's definitely movement in that direction, and I really hope that that's not the only type of movement. What that does do, though, it does a couple of positive things. One, it certainly shows a lot of people that these sites are viable in the sense that you can clean them and reuse them and make money in the process, and I think that's an important lesson that has to be learned. And it also, approaches that size are clearly needed in some of the larger sites, but we don't want to lose sight, though, that many of the sites that need attention are much smaller sites.
I am afraid our time is up, and we've been talking about brownfields as a means of developing cities and hopefully protecting greenfields. My guests have been Charlie Bartsch from the Northwest Midwest Institute in Washington and Juanita Joyner of ISLES, a nonprofit community development corporation in Trenton, New Jersey. Again, we've been talking about brownfields, and let's hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I'm your host, Peter Burley.
Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. This is the time of year when animals are on the move, taking advantage of the changing seasons. Vos swifts are just one of many bird species moving from south to north. Vos are common on the West Coast, and each year, University of Oregon biology professor Dan Gleason says people await their return.
They're coming in large numbers, and they will, each evening, coming into a local tall chimney here on the campus of the University of Oregon. So you'll see large numbers of these birds just before sundown, thousands gathering in the sky and circling around the chimney into a big funnel cloud that disappears down into the chimney in a matter of minutes. So it's almost as if you were watching smoke pouring out of a chimney, but in reverse.
Gleason says this year he estimates the swarms of swifts are comprised of about 5,000 birds. In the fall, the numbers are about twice that. Swift's natural habitat is in hollowed-out trees, but as forests have been replaced by cities, chimneys have made good substitutes. Gleason says swifts are natural flyers, spending most of their time in the air. Unlike other birds, their feet are too small to roost on tree limbs, and they rarely land on the ground because their wings are poorly constructed for ground takeoffs.
Almost all of their activities are in the air, except when they're on the nest or roosting. Swifts are probably the fastest of any of the birds in the world. They have narrow, pointed wings, so in order to get good lift, they need to fly it fairly fast. So they fly typically 30 to 45 miles an hour or so when they're foraging. There are reports of white-throated swift flying at speeds close to 200 miles an hour when eluding a diving peregrine falcon.
A swift nest is often made of material they've been able to accumulate while flying. This doesn't leave them much to work with, so they've developed ways of coping. Gleason says the swift's building secret is also the secret for a famous soup recipe.
They have very large salivary glands, and they secrete a sticky saliva, and they use that to glue the nest material to actually the structure, and it's very tight. There's a swiftlet in Asia, southern Asia, that's the entire nest is just a little shelf of this dried saliva, and it's that's used for the bird's nest soup.
Mmm. Nothing like a cup of dried swift saliva soup. Maybe this is the way to solve funding problems for a higher education in Oregon. We can train the undergraduates to climb into campus chimneys and scoop out all the old bird's nests and sell them to fancy restaurants. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, amendments to federal budget bills are designed to eviscerate protection for endangered species and wilderness areas. We lock horns over whether a landfill should be constructed near the Joshua Tree National Park in California. Feisty Terry Swearingen demonstrates the passion which earned her the 1997 Goldman Prize for being the most outstanding citizen environmental advocate in North America. And our ear to the ground meets a professor who hangs out his laundry rather than use electricity from a nuclear plant. We're spiritually renewed on the pathway as we walk across France and Spain on a pilgrimage, and Nova Scotia's Rankin family finds their renewal crossing a river. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. It's budget time on Capitol Hill. And the environment, like almost every other form of endeavor, is an issue. Things are not as dramatic as last year when budget cutters threatened to put the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency out of business. But Greg Whetstone, legislative director for the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, a national environmental organization, says proposed riders on appropriation bills could seriously undermine protection for endangered species as well as wilderness areas.
We're looking at a bill that would provide some funding relief for flood victims, and unfortunately, in a move that is disturbingly like those we saw in the last Congress, some of the more extreme forces in the Senate and in the House as well are seeking to add provisions that would undermine important environmental protections. In this case, what's at risk is the Endangered Species Act, for one. There is a proposed loophole that would allow any work on any kind of water project that could be associated with flood control to proceed without any regard for protection of endangered species. So the requirements of that law are simply suspended. That has tremendous repercussions, particularly for protection of salmon in the Northwest, which are often at risk through flood control efforts. Then there's a second provision, which is another anti-environment rider, if you will, that's been added onto this budget bill. And that concerns an effort to open up a loophole that would allow the construction of roads and highways through protected areas in our national forest and wilderness areas and wildlife refuges. Basically, this is a proposal that says if there's an existing right-of-way, which could be interpreted to mean a burrow trail, a footpath, then that is considered enough to allow the construction of roads and highways through that wilderness area. And usually following the construction of roads is development, and we lose the qualities that we're protecting these areas for to begin with. So this is two extremely important efforts to weaken crucial environmental protections.
Whetstone says that as in the past, the environmental community will be trying to eliminate those expenditures that hurt the environment, such as Forest Service road building, which enables clear-cut timber sales on public lands that actually lose money. These battles will be fought out in coming weeks, but first his concern is to maintain protections in existing environmental law.
But what we're seeing right now, unfortunately, is a return to the days of the last Congress, where their efforts to put, you know, direct attacks on landmark environmental protections and sneak them on the budget bills. And to their credit, the Clinton administration is saying that they will veto these measures if they survive, and we hope that they don't get that far, but if they do, we are hopeful we'll get a veto.
Another budget issue to watch is Superfund. This is the program to clean up toxic waste sites. A tax on petroleum and certain other products has been assessed for some time and deposited in a fund to pay for cleanup. That tax has now expired. Cleanup is still going on, but it will end if the tax is not reauthorized. At the moment, reauthorization of the tax is being held up in the Congress because some legislators want to change the Superfund law before funding for cleanup is renewed. This opens a major controversy because some insurance company and industry lobbyists want the public to pay more for the cleanup costs as opposed to the polluting industry that caused the problem in the first place. The proposal is strongly opposed by environmentalists who consider the principle that the polluter should pay is fundamental to their beliefs. Recently, proposed developments on the outskirts of parks have been getting a lot of attention. The federal government has committed to buy out a planned gold mine next to Yellowstone. 1.5 miles from the Joshua Tree National Park in California, the Eagle Mountain Landfill is under consideration. It's being designed by the Mine Reclamation Corporation to provide a long-term solution to the waste disposal needs of Riverside County and the Southern California region. Proponents say the site has favorable climate and geological features, as well as rail access, and that MRC will donate $1 per ton of trash to preserve other habitats. Opponents argue the facility will worsen the park's air quality and harm wildlife and destroy habitat. We're joined by Rick Daniels, president of the Mine Reclamation Corporation, and Brian Hughes, Pacific Regional Director for the National Parks and Conservation Association. They lock horns over the question, should the proposed Eagle Mountain Landfill in the proximity of the Joshua Tree National Park be approved? Mr. Daniels.
Yes, it's critical that Eagle Mountain be permitted and approved. Eagle Mountain Landfill and Recycling Center Project is a project to reclaim an abandoned iron ore mine that has been devastated by 40 years of mining activity. It's in a remote, isolated area and is designed to provide non-hazardous solid waste disposal capacity for Southern California. Currently, there are over 30 landfills handling 135,000 ton a day of non-hazardous municipal solid waste in Southern California. And those landfills fail to meet the current groundwater and air quality requirements and must be closed because they're harming neighborhoods and the environment.
Mr. Hughes, in response.
Well, yeah, we see Eagle Mountain Landfill as being the worst kind of land use planning. Our national parks are set aside to preserve those elements that define us as a nation. And Joshua Tree National Park represents some of the most pristine desert environment in the country. And to put a landfill here is simply an untoward development. We appreciate the need to find responsible solutions to landfill and capacity requirements for our state's waste needs. However, we would expect that there be a process by which sites can be chosen and permitted that don't affect our precious natural resources.
Okay. Mr. Daniels, in reply.
The landfill is designed to protect the park. It's blocked by a mountain range. It's not visible. It's been through 8 years of public review. It creates over 1,500 jobs, and the public supports this project 3-1 throughout the state of California.
Mr. Hughes, the last word.
I disagree. Our own polling shows that over 68% of Californians oppose this landfill. And quite frankly, to say that we can put 20,000 tons of garbage per day for over 100 years with no impacts to the natural processes of Joshua Tree National Park is simply not true. We expect that the Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors will realize the economic downturn that this landfill represents and vote accordingly.
Gentlemen, thank you both. We've been joined by Rick Daniels of the Mine Reclamation Corporation and Brian Hughes of the National Parks and Conservation Association debating the proposed Eagle Mountain landfill near the Joshua Tree National Park in California. Gentlemen, thank you both. While environmental groups duke it out with corporations over things like the Eagle Mountain landfill, community members like you and me can be the real forces in these debates. Terry Swearington is a nurse and mother from East Liverpool, Ohio, who began to speak out 15 years ago against a proposed incinerator. She is the 1997 Goldman Prize winner for North America. The $75,000 prize is awarded by the Goldman Foundation each year to one environmental activist from each continent. I asked Terry Swearington what she did to fight the incinerator, which has since gone into operation.
First of all, we educated ourselves. I think that was the most important thing, and then tried to branch out and try to educate others. And then when we really got nowhere through the regulatory agencies, or really people who were set up to protect public health and the environment, we decided that we had to draw more attention to the issue, and we engaged in peaceful, nonviolent direct action or civil disobedience. And some of those things that we did, you know, ultimately ended in our arrest, and we were jailed for our actions.
And so how much time did you spend in jail?
Well, I've spent a total of about 15 days in jail. I still have 15 days left at the local level in the county jail. I'm on a waiting list.
Is that when bed space is available?
Well, yeah, they kind of have a waiting list because, there's just not enough space. So I guess they, you know, you have to wait your turn to get in. It is kind of funny, but, I have spent time in not only the county jail and the local jail, but in Washington, D.C. jail as well, and I think that was the most difficult.
You say that you went to the government, presumably with your public health background. You said you're concerned about lead levels. What did they say?
You know what? It seems as if the regulatory agencies and the agencies set up to protect human health and the environment only do their job if it doesn't conflict with corporate interests. Really, it was the whole process. I mean, they run you through this process of public hearings, really all just sham processes, almost to rubber stamp the permits if this is something that the government backs because of the backing of a big corporation or whatever it seems like. And that's really one of the lessons that we've learned in all of this is that corporate interests prevail.
Swearington believes that the incinerator was built because corporate money won over common sense. She says when a project like this goes through, it signals a breakdown of a democratic process.
Looking at this facility, it is not needed, it is not wanted, and it's not safe. Right now in this country, and this is according to US EPA figures, there is excess incineration capacity. I mean, I think it's ridiculous. It's insane that the existing incinerators that I mentioned earlier are not even operating at capacity, and yet they thought that they had to build another one right next door to an elementary school.
And so how does one get to the fellows that are generating the stuff that goes to the incinerator? I mean, that's really what you're talking about.
I don't think that they're going to do it on their own because there's one thing that we have learned is that there are two kinds of experts in this country. There are experts who work in the corporate interest, and then there are experts and non-experts, just average citizens like myself, who work in the public interest. And in order, and The problem with going to the corporate experts is that they all have the same value system, and that value system says make a profit at any cost. We're looking at short-term economic gain. And so unless it's mandated by the federal government that, you know, there should be some law enacted that they have to reduce, you know, the amount of waste that they're generating, or go to zero emission standards, or have to, or be, you know, forced into using new facilities, clean production technologies. Unless they're forced into that position, I don't think they're going to do it. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is restore democracy. I think that what we have seen now in this country is that we actually live in a wealthocracy, a society that grants influence and power in direct proportion to wealth. I think that campaign money and corporate dollars interfere with proper representation, and this crosses party lines. I'm not pointing my finger at Democrats or Republicans. I think it's in general our government is paying more attention to the moneyed interests and giving them more access than they are to ordinary citizens.
Terry Swearingen is a nurse from East Liverpool, Ohio, and the winner of the 1997 Goldman Prize for North America.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, close the plants, hang your pants, the clothesline plan, a positive approach to change in your backyard. A group of college kids in New England find the answer to their environmental concerns are blowing in the wind with the clothesline plan, an anti-nuclear campaign. The idea, explains founder and Middlebury College senior Alex Lee, is to educate the public about the dangers of nuclear facilities and the benefits of solar energy by encouraging communities to give up their clothes dryers. The group has been hanging giant symbolic clotheslines on college campuses and
trying to get people to hang out their clothes in their dorm rooms around campus.
Lee says the plan, which is a project of Free the Planet, the largest national student environmental organization, is using clotheslines as a way to air their grievances about the costs and dangers of nuclear energy. By hanging clothes out to dry, Lee hopes individuals will be encouraged to take environmental issues into their own hands and think about how they can make changes in their own lives.
Drying machines use a lot of electricity in our household. I think they're second to the refrigerator in terms of appliances.
The group has sent out packets of information to other campuses, sells wooden drying racks made by a local artisan, and Lee says answers questions like, can I hang out my clothes in the wintertime?
That high school chemistry stuff about solids turning to vapor without going through the liquid state really is true, and people can definitely do that year-round. We have in my household my entire life hung out our clothes. All you need is a little bit of sunshine.
Your clothes will smell better, he adds, last longer, and clothes on a clothesline are beautiful. Lee hopes the clothesline plan will catch on beyond college communities. He recognizes that clotheslines alone won't eliminate the need for electricity, but thinks that hanging out clothes is a proactive way to respond to our overly consumptive habits and to point out the dangers of nuclear power plants. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
The Environment Show wants to hear from you, and I'm Peter Burley. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Leave a message and we'll get back to you. Our email address is green@wamc.org. Tell us what's on your mind about the environment and send us your questions. You can visit us anytime where you can hear The Environment Show anytime over the Internet. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Lee Hoinaki, author of the book El Camino, presents a portrait of his special place, which he describes by its light and the effect it has on his being. For him, the place is the path which he traversed as he made a pilgrimage from France to Santiago de Compostela in Spain. It's believed to be the burial place of St. James. Hoinaki walked 500 miles in 32 days over spectacular and ancient terrain.
After several hours, I begin to feel something new, something never before experienced. I strongly sense with my whole self that I am moving from one place to another. Puzzled, I nevertheless clearly realize that I have never tasted anything like this, never known about this. I am not passing through space as one does in a car or airplane. This is a radically different sensation. I feel I am in a place, actually in an infinite number of places. I am not in an undifferentiated space, what one feels in many modern places that really are none places. They are simply repetitions of concepts. The concept of hospital space, shopping mall space, airport space, highway space, suburb space, and so on. Here, with each step, I am always in place, in some place, going to the next place, 1 centimeter or half a meter farther on. There is something solid about where I am at every moment. And all my senses seem to be more open, more aware. They seem to be taking in much more. It's as if I'm plowing through infinitely different perceptions, for with every step I am in a different place, and each place has its own unique character. At each step, if I stop and sense where I am, what is around me, I know, I see, that it is different from the previous place. Is this what poets mean when they celebrate the wonders of creation? Being out here in creation, I sense too that the light is always specific to the place and the moment. There is no such thing as undifferentiated light, as more or less light. The character of light changes constantly with the soil under each step, since light too is particular and contributes strongly to my sense of this place and moment differing from all the others. As the thickness of the air changes with each meter of elevation, so too the quality of the light in each distinct space. Part of my sense of fixing a certain place in my memory derives from the nature of the light illuminating or hiding that scene or spot. In this place, for example, I shall never forget the way the early morning light filtered down through the pine trees with just a suggestion of mist here and there. In conventional terms, I am surrounded, both yesterday and today, by an attractive landscape. But that is not what I experience. I do not look at a scene. Rather, I move into what I see. I become more and more immersed in a new kind of beauty. The creation is good. That is, a good specifically made to be enjoyed as beauty.
Lee Hoinaki, from his book El Camino, about his pilgrimage from France to Santiago de Compostela in Spain. Thank you. Lee Hoinaki met many challenges on his journey. Sometimes he would walk all day through driving rain. Other days his muscles ached. He found that encountering sacred spaces, both natural and human-made, brought him spiritual renewal. The Rankin family is a folk group from Nova Scotia. The River, a song off their release, Endless Seasons, talks about the positive changes a journey can bring. The River, a song by Nova Scotia's Rankin family off their release, Endless Seasons. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 384. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer, Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.